Okay, so this morning we're going to be looking at a text from the Sermon on the Mount. This has come about for a couple of reasons, but I remember not long ago I was listening to this minister who I actually really enjoy, and I heard him talking to somebody, and somebody said, if Jesus came down to earth today, what do you think would be his message to the world? And he said, and I quote, the same one he's been telling you for 2,000 years. He would probably walk into whatever place and start repeating the Sermon on the Mount. And I thought, wow, that's pretty clever. So I was inspired. We're going to do a series of messages from the Sermon on the Mount because there's some really good stuff in there. And I picked this one to start with because it addresses salt. And when Dad was staying with me last week after surgery, they told us to limit his salt intake. So I made a pot of chicken rice soup with no salt in it. And if chicken rice soup loses its saltiness, what is it good for? So I ended up, you throw it out and trample it underfoot. So I got to put salt in mine, but Dad just put a lot of pepper in his. So we're going to be looking at this text this morning where Jesus is addressing salt and light. And so we're going to look at that text this morning. And so Jesus has just finished the Beatitudes. And if you're wondering why I didn't start with the Beatitudes, because I didn't want to. And so we're gonna start with this. So Jesus has just finished the Beatitudes, and he segues nicely into this phrase. He says, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. Now, if you think about all the different analogies Jesus could have used in communicating discipleship, and that's really what this section is about. It's about being disciples. Now, remember, this is 3 years roughly before Pentecost. So this is not a message to the church. This is just a message to the Jewish people. And this is long time before the crucifixion and the resurrection. So this is just Jesus talking to the Jewish people, and he says, you're the salt of the earth. Now, what's really interesting, if you think about why he used that analogy of salt, can anybody tell me why you think Jesus would have chose salt as the analogy here instead of just going right into light? Anybody got a good guess? Because the Dead Sea... Good job, Jim. See, this is why it's so fun having a former minister, a retired minister in the church, because he knows all the answers, everything. The Dead Sea is just a few miles from Jerusalem. It's less than a day's walk. And so it is very likely that a significant number of the people who were at the Sermon on the Mount have been to the Dead Sea. Now, if you know anything about the Dead Sea, it is the lowest point, is the lowest body of water on earth. It's like between 350 and 400 feet below sea level. It is so salty. And just to give you some context, for those of you who are like, I've never been to the Dead Sea, don't plan on going, that's not a vacation spot. So here's a statistic that will probably blow your mind. I know because it blew mine. The Dead Sea is 9 times saltier than the Atlantic Ocean. Now, if you've ever been to the beach and got a mouthful of water, and you're like, whew, that's salty. And you know what it's like when you go to the ocean, how it makes your nose run, and it's all that salt, and you know how it dries your skin out and everything. The Dead Sea is 9 times saltier than the Atlantic Ocean. If you fell into the Dead Sea, you would not sink. Because it's so salty, it's so saline, that you can't sink in it. If you push somebody underwater, they'll come back up.
Yes, I did.
Jim, have you done that? You've done that, Jim? Jim's tested the theory. So if you'd like more information on that, please see Jim afterwards. And so even in biblical times, Salt was a major commodity in this part of the world because the Dead Sea is so full of it that salt was exported all over the world, or all over the Roman world, from the Dead Sea region. So these people would have been exceptionally familiar with salt. Now also keep in mind that in an era of no refrigeration, the main ingredient to preserve meats was salt. So salt would have been well known to the people in this region, both as a preservative and as a flavor enhancer. Now, a lot of the commentaries debate which one Jesus is actually trying to use as an example here. Is it Christ as a preservative of the world, or is it, hey, life is better with Jesus, it's the salt of the earth? And the truth is, it doesn't really matter. That would kind of, if you argue that too much, you kind of miss the point. But here's what's really significant about this. It's not really the role of salt that's so significant as this statement. If the salt has become tasteless, now in your translation, it may say unsalty. If the salt has become tasteless or unsalty, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. Now, one of the things that's really interesting about salt is that if you went out and you got a big cart full of salt, and then at some point you realize that when you took the salt and tasted it, it didn't taste salty. It didn't taste salty anymore. So it wasn't any good to put on your food. And you realize that the salt also, because it didn't taste salty anymore, now it wasn't even useful as a preservative. So now, what have you got? You've got a cart full of salt that doesn't serve a purpose. Now, here's the problem with that. Why would you throw it out? Because salt is heavy. Salt is heavy, and it takes up a lot of space. So salt that doesn't serve a purpose is not only not worth anything, but it's detrimental. And it's detrimental because it takes up space where you could keep other things, and it's a tremendous amount of weight to haul around for no purpose. Any of you ever hauled around something for no purpose? Some of you are probably going, I'm not answering that question. Not answering that question. Not today. If you think about salt, salt is fairly heavy, and it takes up a lot of space. And so, if you've got this salt that you've brought from the Dead Sea, and you've got it in a part of your house, and it's taken up space, and you realize one day that it doesn't serve its purpose anymore, now it's just taken up space that other things could be stored in. It's a tremendous amount of effort to keep it there, and it's a bother. So take that example now and think about what Jesus is saying about his followers who aren't useful anymore. Now, when we think about relationship with God, we tend to think about it in the context of God being useful to us, right? God is very useful to me because he's going to keep me from going to hell. That's incredibly useful. Or he's there for me to throw my request to when I have a prayer request and I've got a sick person I want to pray for. I throw those up to God. And so he's incredibly useful for answering my prayers. And he's incredibly useful for providing me with salvation. And he's incredibly useful for me to vent to when I'm angry. And he's incredibly useful for me to reference in different parts of my life. But how often do we stop and say, how useful does he find me? Now, the truth is, we generally don't think in that context. We generally look at the relationship between God and us as being a one-way deal, and it's always about how he is useful to us and not how we are useful to him. And so when Jesus is talking about this relationship as disciples, He says very clearly, what good are you if you aren't salty anymore? And some of you are thinking, oh, I'm incredibly salty. Let's not use salty as a negative, because that's where some of you are going with this right now. He says, if I've got people who claim to be my people, who claim to be my children, and they are of no use to me, they don't serve any discernible purpose for me, then one must ask the question, what good are they? Now, let's go back to an analogy that we used recently in a sermon where we talk about the fact that we are literally the children of God. How many of you have ever known a person who at some point in their life, maybe when they got older or something happened, that their children did nothing for them? Ever known anybody like that? Somebody came in to Dad's room right before he left the hospital, and he said, now, Mr. Woodley, where are you going when you get out of here? And he said, my daughter-in-law's house. And I was like, Dad, I'm standing right here. And he smiles, because he was feeling a little sassy that day, I guess. And he smiles and he says, he's there too. But he was very quick. He was very quick to tell people, hey, I'm very fortunate. My son lives here in Greenville. I'm going to his and his wife's house, and I'm going to stay with them until I'm well enough to go back to Crestville. And when I go back to Crestville, my daughter and her husband literally live 500 yards down the road, and they'll come and stay with me as much as they need to. They can be there at night, and they're right down the road if I need something. And he was very quick to tell nurses and doctors and the social work and everything, hey, my kids are there. My kids have been really good helping take care of me, and it's very fortunate that we are able to do that. But I would guess that there are plenty of you in this room who have experienced a circumstance where you knew people whose children, for whatever reason, were not really connected to them anymore. Maybe there were some hard feelings in the relationship over the years, or maybe the kids have all moved off and they're not around. But whatever the scenario, there's the person in their old age, and the kids are just nowhere to be seen, don't seem to have any interest in them. And in those circumstances, how many of you have ever thought in your mind, what kind of kids do they have that won't even help their parents in their old age? Any of you ever thought that? So, let's take that analogy and look at what Jesus is saying here. What good are my kids when they won't do anything for me? That's essentially what Jesus is saying here, right? I got all these kids. I'm going to have all these kids. They're the salt of the world. But you know what? What good do they become when they become tasteless, when they don't function to preserve this world anymore, when they stop serving a purpose, and they just start taking up space? Any of you ever known a person or a thing that just seemed to take up space? When I was in college, we had these assignments we would be given occasionally, and we would be divided into teams. And you'd have these groups of people work on an assignment together. And it never failed. There was always somebody on the team who contributed nothing. Nothing. They just took up space and got credit for the grade. Now, I tried really hard not to be that person, because I knew how people talked about those people. I didn't want to be that person. So some of you are thinking, Stuart, I bet you were one of those people. No, I wasn't. I was a good student in college. Not an exceptional student, but I was a good student. I don't want to exaggerate it. I was a good student, not a great student. But I was a good student. And so I tried to contribute. Now, occasionally I get on a team with somebody who is so afraid of making something lower than an A plus that they just want to do all the work by themselves, and I wasn't going to fight them for it. But generally speaking, I would do my fair share. Okay, so we understand this analogy. I think all of us get this, that Jesus here in looking at the role of an individual in the kingdom says, here's what I want you to know. What happens when I have this creation, this child of God, who stops being useful? And isn't salt anymore. And I want you to listen very carefully to what Jesus says. It is no longer good for anything except to be what? Thrown out. Now that's an image of Jesus and relationship that we don't consider very often, because we go, well, Jesus would never throw me out. I mean, he would never throw me. I mean, he totally wouldn't do that. Do you know how many times in Scripture analogies are used by Jesus about worthless servants, branches that produce no fruit, salt not being salty and being trampled underfoot? Yeah, I mean, those analogies are frequent in Scripture. And we just kind of, we miss those because they're inconvenient to us, because we don't, and so we rarely stop and ask the question, I mean, do I serve any purpose? Am I still useful in the kingdom, or am I just kind of mooching off God's grace, trying to coast to the finish line, as if that's how it works? Now, after Jesus addresses salt, he moves into a different analogy, which we're going to talk about next. He says, you are the light of the world. So he's addressed you as salt. Now he says, you're the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Now, why would Jesus say that? That a city on a hill can't be hidden. Why do you think Jesus uses that analogy? Jerusalem's on a hill. Jerusalem's on a hill. By the way, Rome is on a hill. Rome's on seven hills. But Jerusalem's on a hill. So Jesus understands Jerusalem is on a hill, and he says, you can probably see Jerusalem from miles away. And even if you wanted to obscure Jerusalem, it would be impossible. Because it's on a hill, it's elevated. And even at night, what happens in Jerusalem? People light lamps. Torches light the city. They've got light everywhere. In World War II, there's a great example of, it's probably one of the best examples of paranoia. In World War II, after Pearl Harbor, there was a fear on the West Coast that the Japanese were going to invade the West Coast of the United States. Now, if you know anything about logistics, that was a practical impossibility. The United States was too massive a country for a nation the size of Japan to invade, number one. That would have been almost impossible. Number two, logistically, moving that size force all the way across the Pacific. It's one thing to attack Pearl Harbor with planes and boats, but an actual invasion of the West Coast would have been practically impossible, logistically unlikely. But because of fear of that, they would issue blackout orders to cities on the West Coast. And one of the most prominent ones was Los Angeles. Now, imagine even in the 1940s how lit up at night Los Angeles must have been. And we're saying, you know what? We want to cut all the lights off. We don't want any lights in Los Angeles so that ships, Japanese ships, cannot pull up off the coast and start lobbing shells into Los Angeles. Have any of you ever been on a ship coming into a city at night? Two of the most beautiful sights I have ever seen in my life, right after me and Stephanie got married, we did one of these cruises where if we would go look at your timeshare thing and tell you no, we got like a day cruise to the Bahamas. Now, we stayed in a hotel with chalk outlines. I'm not going to lie to you. That was a scary place. But hey, it was free. They paid for it. And I sat by the door all night thinking somebody's coming in here and I'm going to get them before they get me. But we got the cruise. Well, when we cruised back into Florida from the Bahamas, we came in at night and we sailed into Miami after dark. It was the most beautiful thing in the world to be 10 miles off the coast as you're coming in on the ship and the city's lit up. Oh, it was incredibly beautiful. Then later in life, when we actually had enough money to take a decent cruise, we were sailing out of St. Martin at night. And the entire hillside, all the homes were lit up. Just stunningly beautiful. Jesus says, when you've got a city on a hill, there's no way to hide it. You can't hide it. It's not a question of wanting to hide it. You just can't. You can't hide it. It's impossible. So think what Jesus is communicating to those people on the side of that mountain as he's doing the Sermon on the Mount and what that message must mean for the church. He's saying that if the church is what the church is supposed to be, you can't hide the influence of the church. You can't hide it. It's so obvious. It's so out there. It's so bright that you can't hide it, even if you wanted to hide it. You shouldn't be able to hide the church. How easy is it in our culture today to totally not even be aware that the church is there? And what does that say? 2,000 years ago, Jesus told a group of followers on the side of a mountain, hey, when my people are together, they are the light of the world. And when you put them all together in a spot, you can't hide their influence. It's impossible. Listen to the language. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. He doesn't say it's difficult to hide or it's problematic to hide or, well, you could do it if in the right circumstance. He said you can't hide it. You can't hide it. He said, nor does anyone light a lamp and then put it under a bushel or a basket. He says, what do you do with a light? You put it on a lampstand. Now, one of the most entertaining things in the world is for me now, as I'm in my 50s, to watch my kids when there's a power outage. The first thing they do when the power goes out is to take inventory to see how much charge they got left on their cell phone. Because when the cell phone's out of juice and the tablet or the laptop's out of juice, we are now back in the Stone Ages. We now have to sit down and actually talk to people. We can't even text them across the room. We actually have to verbalize communication. What a terrible thing. I thought it was bad for me in the 80s when the Atari wouldn't work. But at least we still knew how to talk. Last time the power was out, Sam comes to the top of the stairs and she yells downstairs. She goes, Dad. And I went, yeah. She said, this is exhausting. I said, what? She goes, every time I want to talk to you, I got to walk to the stairs. Usually, if she really needs something, she'll just text me. Hey, Dad, you know where this is? You know, she'll just send me a text message through the house. But now she's got to walk out of her room and come to the top of the stairs. It's exhausting. And Caleb, I just hear Caleb yell out of his room, "Is the power out?" Everything in the house has gone out. And then, did you pay the electric bill? No, it's just out everywhere, son. It's out everywhere. We have become so acclimated to electricity and stuff that I think this analogy, we struggle with this somewhat because we don't think about candle power. And some of you may have grown up in an era before every house had electricity. Some of you may be old enough to remember living in a house where it was an oil lamp at night. Or maybe your house was the last one in the neighborhood to get electricity. Some of you may remember that. Some of you may remember having to get the oil lamp to go to the outhouse at night. But for a lot of us, this analogy is kind of lost on us because everything's so lit up now. We're like, I don't get it. But Jesus is saying, look, when it's dark, when it's really dark, and if you've ever been out in the country at night and you know what country dark is. And I remember the first time my kids were outside in Kressel at night and they really noticed how much darker my dad's yard is at night than the street in front of their house. Because we have street lights on our road. There's all this ambient light from Greenville. You can't see hardly any stars. It's not dark as much as it's just kind of hazy. But boy, when you get out in Kressel at night, that's country dark. That's country dark. That's can't see your hand in front of your face dark. And so when you understand that was how all these people lived, and Jesus says, so guys, when it's pitch black outside, when it's dark at night and you light a lamp, you light something, what do you do with it? You put it on a lampstand so it can light the whole room. Because what kind of person would light a candle and then cover it? What would the point be? So here's the question. When Jesus gives us the Holy Spirit to shine in us, Jesus has a really good question. Why are you trying to cover that up? Why do you not want everyone to see the light that's in you? Why isn't that light shining? And when all of us are together who have that same light, why isn't our light brighter than it is? So that people in the world cannot go, I don't see the church anywhere. No, you can't miss us, right? That's what Jesus is saying. When my people are together and are in one accord, when they're on the same page, when they have this light in them, it should be unmistakable. You shouldn't be able to miss it. Even if you want to, you shouldn't be able to. He says, you put it on a lampstand and it gives light to all who are in the house. In verse 16, he says, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Now, it's interesting here because Jesus is, and we, it's funny because we actually talked about this a little bit last Sunday night in our study. This notion that Jesus says, let your light shine before men in such a way that they see your good works, and then who do they attribute those good works to? To God, not to you. And a lot of times we want people to say, man, what a great person that is. Or, you know, wow, that minister is a really good guy, and man, he's done a great job, and man, that person is really active in the community, and man, what a great person they are. And Jesus says, no, the object here. Now look, obviously, if people give you credit for being a good person, you don't really have a lot of control over that. But he says you should be directing that towards who? The Father. He says the object of the church, of my people, whether it's the people on the side of this mountain or the people at Pentecost or the church today, he says the object is for all of us to let our light shine before men in such a way that they see who we are. and glorify our Father because of what we're doing. Now, I want you to note something here. He doesn't say, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may hear what you're saying. Somewhere in, and I don't know what even, I don't even know what time frame to put this in. So we'll just go to the largest time frame and say sometime between when Jesus said this and now, we've gotten this thing twisted. And we have adopted this policy, which is, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may hear the things that we say and glorify the Father that's in heaven. But that's not what Jesus said. Jesus didn't say you need to go out and talk a good game. He said, what do you need to do? You need to get out and do the work. Any of you ever known somebody that talked a really good game? You know, that you listen to him talk and man, they're the best in the world. That person, man. I used to really enjoy when I was a kid. Now, I don't have a lot of use for it anymore. I acknowledge this. But when I was a kid, when I was like 12, 13, 14, right up through college, I loved wrestling. And it was wrestling. It wasn't wrestling. That's just too highfalutin. It was wrestling. And you know what I really enjoyed about wrestling? It wasn't watching the guys fight. It was listening to them talk. Ric Flair. Woo! I used to have the hair where I could, but I don't have the hair anymore, but I still got the woo. I used to love to listen to Ric Flair talk about whoever he was fixing to fight. Oh, it was high. That was high comedy. That was good stuff. Now I'm going to go way back now. As a kid, man, listening to Wahoo McDaniel. Oh, man, Wahoo McDaniel. Man, those guys, Rufus R. Freight Train Jones. That guy was fun to listen to because you couldn't understand a word he said. But he said it with some passion. And these guys would talk so much stuff, and you just sit there and you'd just be enamored. It's like, man, that's amazing. And then they'd talk all that mess and then go out there and somebody'd beat the stuffing out of them and they'd be all bloody afterwards. But you know what? It didn't matter because next week they were going to start talking again and you loved listening to it. It was fantastic. And you know, I remember my dad one time looking at me going, you know, all that's fake. It seemed real to me. And by the way, you watch Lawrence Welk. So you're not allowed to talk about wrestling to me. But he told me, he said, you know, that's all fake. It didn't matter. It didn't matter that it was fake because they talked so good and it was so good to listen to them. And by the way, that's how some televangelists are. They're great to listen to because they talk a lot of stuff. And so it sounds good. It sounds good. But if there's one theme throughout Scripture that has never changed, it was that God is a whole lot more interested in what you do than what you say. There was even a parable about it. There were these two sons. We'll go back to the son analogy here. This father tells two sons, I want you to come work tomorrow. Be there early. We got work to do. One son said, Father, I will be there. And then he did not show up. And then one son said, I'm not coming. But he did show up. And Jesus asked the question, which son is the righteous son? The one who said he would do the work but didn't, or the one who said he wouldn't but did? And so you think about that parable and you think about what Jesus is communicating to his children as he stands on that mountainside and he communicates to those people who were gathered around to listen to him. And if he was here today, I don't think the message would change at all. If he showed up today and said, Stuart, have a seat, I want to preach, I'd be like, okay. He would probably say something very similar to this. Guys, you shouldn't be hidden. It should be impossible for you to be hidden. Especially in a world that's gotten darker and darker, the light should be easier to see, right? The light should be easier to see. In the abject darkness that this world has fallen into, our light should be more visible. It should be harder for the church to be invisible today than at any time in the history of this country. There might have been a time in this country where so many people were religious that you could miss the church because everybody was kind of religious. I don't know that that time really ever existed, but some people may think it did. But at this time in our history, it should be harder than ever for the church to be invisible. Because when you're in country darkness, you know how much light it takes to see the light? Walk into a room sometime that is totally lit up and take out a lighter and light it and then look around the room and see how much light it emits. And you know what you'll find out? Not much. But you walk into that same room at night when all the lights are out and it is pitch black. And then you turn that lighter on. And you know what you find out? It puts light everywhere. Now, you know what hasn't changed? The light. The light hasn't changed. It's the surroundings that have changed. So as we look at our world and the darkness that's in our world right now, we should be more visible than ever. But Jesus says, can I see you? Can I even see you from where I'm at? Can the world see what you're doing? Not hear you, but see you. And by the way, I don't want anyone to say, Stuart, saying we shouldn't witness, we shouldn't tell people. If that's what you're hearing, you are so missing the point. I don't even know where to start. But words without actions generally don't mean much to people. And so at this time in our world, the church needs to be a visible light. We need to be salty again. Now, we're going to look at some other text in the Sermon on the Mount over the next several weeks. But this one, I think, kind of lays the foundation for everything else. Because really, what this is this is a call from Jesus to his people, whether it was the Jews before his crucifixion and resurrection, or whether it was for the church on Pentecost, or whether it's for our church today, the meaning is still the same. This is a call for Jesus' people to be useful, to be salty, to be light in the darkness. This morning, as we get ready to sing our communion hymn, I would encourage you to do some self-evaluation. If the praise team would come on up. I would encourage you to do a little self-evaluation and ask yourself a really good question. Do people see me? Not do people hear me, but do people see me? And when they see me, do they see a big pile of salt that used to be salty? It used to have value. It used to enhance flavor and preserve the world. It used to be like that. But it hadn't been like that in a long time. Is that what they see? Or do they see a person who is adding God's flavor to the world around them and preserving people as they try to escape Satan. And the only person qualified to answer that question is you. And so as you reflect on that this morning, I would encourage you to ask yourself one fundamental question today. Does God find me nearly as useful to him as I find him to me?